You know, there was a couple had two sons, and one was always pessimistic about everything, and the other was always optimistic. Obviously, the optimistic one was going to be a pro-life, probably a helpers, but they felt that they had to help the young boys to be have a realistic approach towards life. And so it was this past Christmas, and they felt, well, maybe by way of the Christmas gift, we'll bring them to a bit of proper approach towards reality. So for the youngster that was always pessimistic, they went out and they bought a very, very expensive bicycle, two-wheeler, all the trappings. And for the youngster that was very optimistic, I said, well, you know what we'll do? We'll get a Christmas sock, and we'll put it on the mantle, and we'll fill it with horse manure. So the boys came down, and the pessimistic one came, and they said, here's your gift, and there's this beautiful bicycle. And he's looking at it, and suddenly his face starts to become somewhat saddened, and looking at him. And then he becomes even like almost ready to cry. What's the matter? And he said, well, you know, I'm going to take this bicycle, and you know what's going to happen? I'm going to be out in the street. I'm going to be in an accident. I'm going to end up in the hospital. I said, in the hospital? He said, yes, now what's going to happen? My friends are going to come, and they're going to want to use my bicycle because I'm in the hospital, and they're probably going to lose it on me. And along it goes. And what this beyond help. And the other fellow comes down, you know, and they say, well, here's the ones always optimistic, always optimistic. And they bring him into the room, and he says, where's my gift? And they bring him in, and they give him the sock filled with horse manure. He looks at it, and a big smile breaks on his face. And he said, what are you smiling about? And he said, where's the pony? Well, that kid's going to be a helper. That's our approach. Where's the pony? See? Because we do believe that God is in this, and he's on our side. He's on our side. You know, I saw the picture you have, Paul, of myself on the cover there. I call that the B.C. picture. B.C. It's not before Christ, but it's before cancer. And I had a young lad in the office, and I've seen this kid grow. He's an autistic lad. And autistic children usually tell you exactly what they're thinking. Right? And I saw him looking at my little nose. See? And he's looking at it, but he's very dramatic. See? And finally, he looks at it, and he says to his mother, who was there, and he goes very dramatically like this, you see? And he points at my nose, and he says, he has a short nose. I said, son, that's the best description I've had yet, a short nose. But it was a good deal, and I have to tell you why. What happened was, I've been about 15 operations on my nose, God knows. God knows. All right? But what happened was, when they took a skin graft, they had to rebuild this nose with an 18 square inch skin graft in my leg. They didn't know if it would take because they already had 32 radiation treatments on this nose. See, every time I go to the dermatologist, they say, Father, now you have to stay out of the sun. I said, yes. We both laugh, we'd make the next appointment. That's been on and on. But so what happened was, because of the radiation, on the nose, they have what they call today hydrobaric oxygen therapy. If you don't know about that, it's a very modern space age type thing. They basically put you in a space capsule, and they turn up the pressure and stimulates the cells and helps the skin graft to take. Now the one who had that before me, I saw, was actor Michael Jackson. He was always getting his nose. You see, but he had it at home. He had the space capsule. It's sort of a rare thing. So I had to go into the space capsule for 40 hours. You know, it was 2 hours every morning. I'd be leave the monastery at 5:30, in the capsule at 6:30, getting out of the capsule at, it's like a space cap. They close you in. I mean, you're sealed. Right? And it's, the pressure on your ears, and I had this silly bandages all over my nose. And I come back, I would say mass and go right down to the abortion clinic with this bandage all over my face. And I came back one day from the clinic and I said to the sister, I am depressed. They said, well, what happened? What happened? I said, well, you know, I had 6 turnarounds today. They said, 6 turnarounds? We use turnarounds, mother comes back, I keep the child, see? I said, yes. They said, what are you depressed about? I said, all this while, I thought it was my good looks. And today I found out it's been God. But you know what happens is when they take this oxygen baric therapy, and it has nothing but positive effects on the body. And one effect, it can affect your eyes. But I had to renew my eye license, my driver's license. They want you to have an eye test. I couldn't read the numbers. So I went to the eye doctor, and he said, let's try without the glasses. And it ended up that I had 20/20 vision as a result of the therapy. They don't need glasses. Amazing. See? So I said to the youngster, my son, it was a good deal, a good deal. One short nose, but 2 good eyes. And you know, they meant well, but they made a prosthetic nose for me, you know? And they put this nose on to cover all this whitish area and everything else. And I looked and I said, God, I've gone from a Catholic priest to a Jewish rabbi. I didn't recognize myself. And my problem was this, they put this prosthetic nose on you, and to keep the nose on your face, you see, you have to wear glasses. But now I don't need glasses, but how do I work this out? So I had these dumb thing nose on, and I was doing counseling. This woman comes, and I'm counseling with my prosthetic nose, you see, and I ran out of materials. And I have my car, and it's like any pro-life car, it's filled with all types of stuff. So I opened up the trunk, and I was trying to get material out of the trunk for the woman that was waiting there, and you know what happened? My dumb nose fell into the trunk. And with all that materials, I couldn't find my nose. And I had to go over to the woman and apologize. And I tell her, look, I'm sorry, I can't find my nose, but I got... You know what, I gave her the materials, and she turned around, so I kept the damn nose, and it's still in the trunk. Why bother with it? That's what it's still in there now, you see? I can't find it. I know it's in there. I saw it go. So my 20/20 vision, I still can't find it. But tonight I do want to speak to you about something that, a talk that even Paul Hammond hasn't heard before. Okay? Paul usually rates me on talks on basis of, is this new or not? Not is it good or not, but is it new? I said to Paul, I would do something different to tonight. And one of the things is, I do want to read this to you first. I was coming back from one of the Eastern Bloc countries, and I was coming back to America. At the time when, you know, the scandals were breaking of the pedophile priest and all this other nonsense, and we're being attacked in the papers galore. And these are some of my thoughts that I had. I just read this before I start here. I said, these days, one would have to be blind or deaf not to read in the newspapers or hear on radio or watch on television the unrelenting attack by so many commentators against the Catholic Church, going on for years in the United States and more recently in Western Europe, for the shameful deeds of a few. One commentator went so far as to say, this may be the end of the Catholic Church. And I thought to myself, you foolish man. It's not the end of the Catholic Church, but rather of Western civilization, whose flawed leaders, by misusing words such as freedom, choice, equality, have anesthetized the people into passively accepting the removal from the laws of the land, all Judaic and Christian values. And without these ethical foundations, Western civilization will collapse and perish into barbarism. For it was the implementing of the moral values found in God's commandments and the recognition in law of the absolute value of every human life created by God that made the laws in Western civilization great and admired. The late Archbishop Fulton Sheen said that it is a characteristic of any decaying civilization that the great masses of the people are unconscious of the tragedy. Humanity in a crisis is generally insensitive to the gravity of the times in which it lives. Men do not want to believe their own times are wicked, partly because they have no standard outside of themselves by which to measure their times. If there's no fixed concept of justice, how shall men know it is violated? Only those who live by faith really know what is happening in the world. The great masses without faith are unconscious of the destructive processes going on because they've lost the vision of the heights from which they have fallen. Country after country, through the legalization of abortifacient contraceptives, abortion, euthanasia, embryo stem cell research, therapeutic cloning, and on, is institutionalized in a structure of sin and death. Organizations such as the European Union and the United Nations too often are becoming the problem and not the answer, due to certain powerful people and groups who manipulate even these institutions into implementing their worldwide culture of death. Thus, tragically today, the light of life for far too many innocent human beings is going out, especially across America and Western Europe, without a whimper from the majority. The light has been dimmed ever so slowly, so that many, without realizing it, have acclimated themselves to live in moral darkness. Others are already despairing of the hope of a new dawn, while those being born into the darkness accept it as the normal condition. How did this happen? How did this happen? There is a professor in the university in Chicago University, and he wrote a book, it was published about 1988-89, and his name was Alan Bloom, and he wrote this book entitled The Closing of the American Mind. And in this book, he made the point. He said, according to Bloom, what we see today is young people who, lacking an understanding of the past and a vision of the future, live in an impoverished present. And today's universities, entrusted with their education, no longer provide the knowledge of the great traditional philosophies and literature that made students aware of the order of nature and of man's place in that order. Higher education fails to arouse or to nurture self-knowledge. And the separation of modern science from the natural philosophies that preceded it results in cultural relativism. For Bloom, a liberal education means precisely helping students to pose the question that every young person must ask, who am I? what is man? Or namely, to follow the Delphic command, know thyself. The liberal, educated person is one who is able to resist the easy and preferred answers of the world. For Professor Bloom, the university, instead of being an island of intellectual freedom where all new views are investigated without restrictions, the universities have become inundated, saturated, and preoccupied with society's problems and questions on health, on sex, on race, on war. And so the result has been that the people inside the universities have become identical with those outside the universities and incapable of giving an answer to the world's problems. Professor Bloom said that the Frenchman who came to America many years ago, Tocqueville, in his rather famous book, Democracy in America, saw that a democratic regime can easily result in an enslavement to public opinion or the tyranny of the majority. The claim of democracy being that each person should decide for himself and to use the use of one's natural faculties to determine for oneself what is true and what is good, what is bad, what is right, is the American philosophical method. The external impediments to that, such as tradition, such as religion, such as family values, such as the great amount of people who have preceded us, are excluded. And the liberation of the person, actually paradoxically, results in a greater reliance, when they exclude this from their education, on public opinion, on what is taking place outside the universities. And they are not able to resolve and to even recognize justice being actually not followed. And so John Paul II, you know, in his encyclical Evangelium Vitae, he emphasized the same type of thought. See, so Bloom is saying that what has happened to our universities is that these causes outside are now on the universities and using the universities to implement their causes. And they are becoming the means of social engineering by way of the universities, and the students, instead of being taught ideas that will be able to reflect and react to the world, they are already part of it and they are caught into it and they are useless. John Paul II, in section 70, is this working?
Okay. Yeah.
Okay. In Evangelium Vitae, he said, we're obligated to resist when a parliamentary or social majority in a democracy decrees that it is legal to kill an innocent unborn child. The Pope stressed that a crime against humanity remains a crime against humanity, whether it is done by an unscrupulous tyrant or legalized by a populist consensus in a democracy. A democracy is a system, a means, it's not an end in itself, and the morality of the laws in a democracy depends on the morality of the ends of what it pursues and the means it employs. The Pope said it is therefore necessary for the future society and the development of a sound democracy to make sure the essential and innate human values which flow from being a human being and expressed must be maintained and the dignity of the person even in a so-called democratic society. And so what has happened is simply this. People are homeschooling their children because the schools have become places of social engineering. People send their children to universities, and instead of being taken and brought back to come in contact with all the great minds and philosophies and traditions in the past, and then to weigh what is happening in the present circumstances against that, that is being totally eliminated. And thanks be to God, when I went to school, instead of closing the mind, the universities and seminaries I went to, they closed the doors and they shut out the modern world. And they brought us on a journey back to people who lived before us. And from those people, you gain a great deal of knowledge. It seems to me that the modern society today, if you could use the words to describe it, it's a tragedy. It's people meaning well destroying themselves. It's a people without wisdom. A people who, when you are involved in education, there's two types of knowledge. There is productive knowledge and there is directive knowledge. Productive knowledge, as you know, teaches a person how to make a living. Directive knowledge teaches you how to live. And people come out, they don't know how to live. They have no wisdom. They can do marvelous things. You want to light up a city? We'll do it. You want to blow up a city? We'll do it. Whatever you want. You want me to help the child to be born? I will do it. You want me to kill the child? I will do it. There's no wisdom. There's no wisdom. And so I was blessed to be, so to speak, instead of closing the minds, of closing the doors, and of going back to people who say a great deal to us today. You know, when I go traveling around the world, I meet people with different languages, different customs, eat the same different foods, and after about a week, I think I never left home, because it's people. It's people. And they can tell you a lot to you of what is happening. But they also can tell you a lot about not just people who you meet here, but people who live before us. And so this evening, I'd just like to bring you a little bit of a journey to people who lived before us, and maybe they can tell us something about our own society. Because when I am on the street, I take what I have learned and I observe and see if this tragedy is being worked out again. 2,500 years ago, there were in Athens, there were great minds, and they wrote tragedies, Aeschylus and Sophocles and Euripides, and Euripides was a man who tried to uplift the place of women in society. 2,500 years ago, if you look at his plays, they all have the name of a woman who was for each of his plays, and he wrote a play called Alcestes. And Alcestes is rather simple, but rather profound. Alcestes is a play in which Alcestes is the queen, and her husband, Admetus, is the king of Thessaly. And according to the play, Apollo, one of the gods, was excluded from heaven for a period of time because of a problem with the king of the gods. And when he came down to earth, he was given hospitality at King Admetus' house. And then came time that he was to return. And when it came time to his return, he wanted to thank the people who helped him. And one of the things he said, you know, I have to tell you, Admetus, you don't realize this, but you are going to have an early death. And he said, I've asked the king of the gods if he would help you, and he said he would. But in order for you not to die, this is what you must do. You must find someone in your kingdom who will die in your place, and you will be spared. And so Admetus, the king, he's so grateful for Apollo for doing that, and he sends the word out. And he sends the word, he starts to ask people, will you die in my place? And he suddenly finds out, very few people are willing to die in your place. And he goes to his own parents. And he says to his parents, you know, I was told by the gods that if someone will die in my place, I will live. And the parents said to him, are you kidding me? Life is precious. This is in the thing, life is precious. You only get one life. Why don't you carry your own cross? That's what they say to him. What are you talking about? You, what kind of man are you? What did we raise? You want your parents to die for you? Carry your own cross. And they wouldn't do it. They wouldn't do it. And so he finally found out the only one who would do it is Alcestes, his wife. And she said, I'll die for you. And he said, oh, how blessed I am. How blessed I am. You see? And she does, and the people are starting to talk. He's going to have to, he's going to have his wife die in this place. And slowly but surely, of course, she starts to die. Right? And he's so very grateful to her, but he finds out that the people are all talking about him. What kind of a selfish man is this? The queen is dying, and he's letting her die. And his whole reputation, his fame is shot. And everybody's talking about him. And he's finding out the only one on the face of the earth that really loves him is the one who's losing. She's dying. He said, my God, what have I done? What have I done? Now, there is an ending, the Deus Ex Machina ending, as they do. God comes in from the machine, and the reprieve is given to in the situation. But I mention that because today, I'm standing outside the abortion clinics, and that mentality, I call it the Admetus mentality, is people want someone else to carry their cross. Everybody is coming and say, well, I have to kill the baby. The baby has to die for me. That's basically what it's saying. And I'm saying, why? Because you're dying? It's not even because you're dying you're killing the kid. At least Amita's is going to die. You see? I mean, it's not death. And still, we're still killing the kid. Eh? And then what happened is, when you're doing this, you say, my goodness, you have to have courage out there. You have to tell these people of your counseling. You have to say, wait a second. Why don't you carry your own cross? What are you putting this on your baby? And by God, the cross is not life and death, but you're taking the life of your child. What kind of a man are you? What kind of person are you? And I tell you this, as that child, when you lose that child, and the child gets closer, you're going to hate yourself, and everybody's going to talk about you. My God, you just need to get a few extra dollars in this, and you killed your kid? What are you doing? And so we have to tell them. We have to tell them outside when you're, and not be afraid. Not be afraid. Say, look, our Lord said, take up your cross and follow me. Are you a Christian? Right? As a matter of fact, God went further than that. He didn't say, take up your cross and follow me. He said, take up your cross and die for another person. I give you a new commandment. Lay down your life for your friend. Lay down your life for your enemy. What are we doing? And so this mentality that's out there, you weigh it against the people, actually 2,500 years ago, and they could tell us this is insane. At least it wasn't the case. One case, a life for a life, but in these cases, it's not at all. You know, about 140 BC, there was a play that Terence wrote in the Latin civilization called The Self-Tormentor. And the man was Menedemus. He was a rich man. He had many slaves. And suddenly this rich man, he changed his whole approach. And what he was doing, he was from morning to night, he was working himself practically to death. Everybody said, he's crazy. He has all this help, all these slaves, why didn't he let them do it? And anybody that went to him, he told him, mind your own business. Mind your own, do you get that on the street? Mind your own business, you see? Get a life. I used to say, what do you think I'm here for? It's to get a life, you see? What are you doing to get a life, you see? And they say, well, get a life, mind your own business. And everybody would back off. Until Cremes came along, see? Cremes. And Cremes came along, and he asked the question. He was told, mind your own business. And that famous line from Terence, he said, homo sum, I am a man. And umani nihil ame puto, alienum. Nothing touching humanity do I consider foreign to me. He said, either what you are doing is right, I want to know why, I'll imitate it. Or what you're doing is wrong, and I feel I must correct you. It is my business, because I am a human being, and this child is a fellow human being. And as a human being, and you as a human being, I must speak to you. And suddenly the man begins to speak and explain why. He said, I felt I drove my son out of my house. I can't stand it. I just keep myself so busy. And the play continues. Now I say to you, not only are you a human being and it's your business to be concerned about the death of your fellow human beings, the child in the womb, but Christianus sum, I am a Christian. And as a Christian, I must be concerned about the body of Christ. Whatever you do to the least of my brethren, I will consider as done unto me. As a Christian and as a human being, I must speak to this person even when they tell me, drop dead, mind your own business. I must say to them, it is my business. This is my brother. This is a member of the body of Christ. Have the courage. Have the courage to speak and to say so. You know, there was another play called Antigone's. Antigone's. Antigone's was a woman who, there was two men, Polynices and Eteocles, and they, Eteocles was inherited the kingdom, and his brother tried to do it over, to overthrow him, and they fought each other, and they both died. They both died. And King Creon, the king of Thebes, he was really absolutely incensed at the brother who killed the other brother. And so he, for the one brother, he had a type of state funeral. And for the other brother, he left him out in the fields, and he's ordered no one in this kingdom can put any type of dirt on that body. Now, in the ancient world, if you didn't have proper burial, if someone didn't throw some dirt on you, they believed the soul of that person was awful. The soul of that person would be wandering for 100 years, and it was the will of the gods that you give proper burial and treat the dead properly, even if they are your enemy. You have no right not to do this. And so the king said, anyone who does this, throws dirt on that body, that person will die. Well, Antigone's, she had this struggle. Do I follow man's law or the divine law? And every night she'd go out and she'd throw dirt on the body. And the king would be incensed the next day. Who did this? And finally he found out it was her. And the price was her life. But the difficulty was, of course, that she said, I have to not follow a law made up by you. I must follow the divine law. I must put God first. And it hurt his heart because he loved her. He didn't think it was her. But he was so incensed, I have to enforce my rotten civil human law, even at the price of the life of this person and the divine law. And she dies. It's that individual conscience, divine law versus man law. And of course, I call the Antigone Moore attitude or courage. Because Thomas More, the same situation. Thomas More, no one was appreciated more by King Henry VIII in all the kingdom than Thomas. But he would stand and say, marriage is God's creation. Marriage is something I must not allow to be compromised, even if it is a king. And he would not sign the document. And it ended up, of course, that Thomas More, actually, he lost his head. But remember how he died. He teaches us. He said, of course, Henry VIII, he knew the person dying had the right to speak. And he knew Thomas would speak, and if he ever had a chance to speak at any length, Henry VIII was finished. He was a tremendous orator. So he said to Thomas, I do not allow you to speak, but you must be totally brief and quick before we behead you. And everybody remembers what he said. Okay? He said, I die the king's good servant, which pierced the heart of Henry, because he was the one most especially wanted to sign. But he would not. He upheld marriage between a man and a woman and what God is. And then he said, I die the king's good servant, but God's first. We must have that same courage as Antigone's today and of Thomas More. When marriage is under attack, when man's laws are in contradiction to God's divine laws, we have to have the courage, I am the king's good servant, but God's first. Don't impose this law on me. I will not pay. I will not obey. So we learn from them. And there was, you know, as you come further down, we come to Shakespeare. When you're talking about tragedies, you cannot absolutely exclude Shakespeare. And there's a play that I'd like to just read a few parts from here this evening, because I think it says an awful lot when I'm out there on the streets of what is taking place. And the play I'm referring to is Shakespeare's Macbeth. And in Shakespeare's Macbeth, you have King Duncan, the King of Scotland, is a king that everyone finds unbelievably good in his office, respected and loved. And Macbeth and his wife, Lady Macbeth, ambition is driving them. And they're plotting to take his life. They are his relatives. They are supposed to be protecting him. And in spite of all of that, he finds himself going to do this. Now, I'm going to read these quotes from Macbeth and then reapply them for you what happens outside the abortion mills that I experience. The king is about, in this end of Act 1, Scene 7, and he's about to do this vile act of killing Duncan. And he says this, "If it were done when it is done, then it would well is done quickly. If the assassination could trample up the consequence and catch with his surcease success, that but this blow might be the be-all and the end-all here, but here upon this bank and shoal of time would jump the life to come. But in these cases, we still have judgment here, that we but teach bloody instructions, which being taught, return to plague the inventor. This even-handed justice commends the ingredients of our poisoned chalice to our own lips. He's here in double trust, first as I am his kinsman and his subject, strong both against the deed, then as the host, who should against his murderer shut the door, not bear the knife myself. Besides, this Duncan hath borne his faculties so meek, hath been so clear in his great office, that his virtues will plead like angels' trumpets tongued against the deep damnation of his taken off, and pity like a naked newborn babe striding the blast of heaven's cherubim's host upon the sightless couriers of the air, that tears shall drown the wind. I have no spur to prick the sides of my intent, but only vaulting ambition, which o'erleaps itself and falls on the other." Later in the play, Lady Macbeth, who was involved in the killing of Duncan, the blood flowed all over her hands. She is trying to wash the blood off her hands, but she cannot. There is no blood there, it's been washed off, but she cannot. And she speaks and she washes her hands endlessly. And they're looking at her, what does this mean? Look at her, she keeps washing her hands continuously. And she says, "Out a damn spot, out." And the doctor's looking at her, "Out what? There's nothing there, there's nothing there." And finally, what I would refer to is, after she dies, and Macbeth, his whole life now is, it's just shattered, it's meaningless. And he gives us those beautiful lines, "Tomorrow and tomorrow and tomorrow creeps in this petty pace from day to day, to last civil of recorded time. And all our yesterdays like fools, the lighted fools, they make the way, have lighted the way to destroy death." "Life is but a walk in shadow," okay, "a walk in shadow, a poor play that struts and frets its way upon the stage and then is heard no more. It's a tale told by an idiot, full of sound and fury, signifying nothing." His life now is absolutely meaningless. Now, I go back over that because when I'm outside the abortion clinic and the people are coming, their attitude is, "I got to get this over with. I've got to get this over. If it is done when it is done, it's got to be done quickly." Right? And only if the death of this child, if it only could trample up the consequences, but it doesn't. And with the death of the child, that it would be the end of it. But this blow, we bypass the eternity and judgment of God. But it says further, not only do we have to deal with God's judgment in these cases, but we have here, "We teach bloody instructions, which being taught return to plague the inventor. The children will kill the parents for the same reason." It's called euthanasia. Having taught the instruction, the bloody instruction, that will come back, and the ingredients of that poison chalice will be brought to our own lips. And it says, we're here in double trust. Double trust. Yes, you are the mother. Yes, you are the father. You are here. You should be the one that will be protecting this child, not the one delivering the blow. And this child is innocent. This child, when the child dies, it will, the sound of the newborn babes, that silent scream, will pierce your heart. And the effects will be there long after. And mothers will go to the doctors and say, there's a post-abortion effect. They say, no, there isn't. There's nothing there. There is. I see it. Out, damn blood. It's the same thing. You have bloody, you experience this, the killing of the innocents. It doesn't go away. It's called post-abortion complex symptoms. And the doctor wants to say, no, there's nothing there. There is there, doctor. And you better take care of it. And you better work with it. And of course, the man that's involved in it, he reaches the point where life is meaningless. It's a tale told by an idiot. They lose all purpose of life. It becomes something that just destroys them. And so there's a tremendous need to reach out to these people and to help them. It's a tragedy, a Greek tragedy, an English tragedy, a Latin tragedy. That's our times. They're tragic times. And we are repeating errors that people knew 2,000 years ago, 1,000 years ago. And it's because they have no wisdom. See, everything that you watch and see on TV, and you're not any wiser. You watch a program on TV, and it makes you laugh, it makes you cry, and after you finish watching it, or crying, or laughing, you're still not any wiser. In order to be wise, you have to see the whole. Pope Paul VI, in Humani Vitae, in section 7, he said, the problem with making any moral judgments is you have to have a total vision. You have to see things in the fullness of their reality. The idea of saying, and you hear this all the time outside the abortion clinics. In my case, it's called situational ethics. Everything is justified because in this case, and you cannot make a moral judgment on the basis of in my case. You have to step back and say, who is man? Is this truly the human thing to do? And you need full vision of the reality. And of course, the literary form that gives us this is called the epic. And of all the genres that are used of communicating, you see where the people or pioneers go in, they start a new society. Later, they start to produce a literature reflecting the values of that society. And later, people read those works to know what is it that our forefathers stood for, what is the values that we stand for. And in an epic is where you see the whole. The greatest writers, practically in the history of mankind, have written in that genre. You have Homer's The Iliad and the Odyssey. You have Virgil's Aeneid. Of course, you have Dante's The Inferno, De Purgatorio, De Paradiso, Milton's Paradise Lost. But what an epic does for you, it makes you see things not in a particular thing. You see there's a whole thing being worked out. And so, for example, in the Aeneid, the thing begins with an end almost at the beginning. The hero is Aeneas. And it opens up with a man saying, oh, thrice and four times blessed are those who are dead. And then he meets this beautiful woman, Dido, in Carthage. She is from a royal family. She has suffered much, just as he who is fled from Troy. And they fall in love. And she says to him, oh, I could never live without you. Right? I could never live without you. If you left me, I'd take my life. But the difficulty, of course, is she is supposed to be, by fate, she is supposed to be heading and taking care of the people in Carthage. And he is supposed to go to Rome and establish the great civilization of Rome. And the men left their families and they followed with him that he would do this. And suddenly he's bogged down. He's bogged down in this situation where this love of this woman for him and he for her is overwhelmed and holding there. And the rest of the men say, what has happened to him? He's not doing what he is supposed to do. And finally, a messenger, the god, is sent by Jupiter Mercury comes to him in the middle of the night and says, "What are you doing? Wake up and get out of here." And suddenly he wakes up and he goes to the shore and all his men are ready before he's off to the sea. And Dido wakes up the next day and she sees the skyline. It's all filled with white sails. "My God," she said, he left. "I will go and I'll kill him. I'll get the Carthaginians." And she said, "Why should I make my people suffer?" And then she ended up building a funeral pyre for her own. And Anna, her sister, weak Anna, her sister, she comes. And Anna, in the beginning, when Dido was falling in love, she was telling, "Yeah, it's okay, it's okay." It's interesting. When she comes in at the end and Dido's about to kill herself, and Anna said, "What are you doing?" And she said, "You, damn you. When I was weak and I was weeping and I went to you for the truth and you were weak, you didn't tell me the truth. You should have said, 'No, don't get involved, it's impossible. You're fated to here and he's fated to leave.' But you didn't do it. You are weak. You brought this death upon me because you were weak and you didn't tell me the truth." Right? And that's it, the weakness of Anna. And she dies cursing her. And Aeneas goes off into sea. And if you see that as the end, that would be something you would see on TV. And you move to tears and you say, "Aeneas, my God, what a rotten man. He killed that woman. He left." And that's where you'd end. But it's not. He was wrong for getting involved. He shouldn't have. But he was right in leaving. And you'll only understand that when you see the whole. When you see the whole of the story. Because if he doesn't leave, you'll never have Rome. If you don't have Rome, you won't have the civilization, the gift that they gave to mankind of law and the great civilization. Yes. So he has to grow up. And so the period that he has in Homer's Iliad and Odyssey, it starts with the war and the wandering of Odysseus. And Virgil took those two books and built upon them. And he reversed it. And he has the first six books of the Aeneid is based on growth, formation, to become what he ought to be. And it's only when he becomes a man, when God brings you through various periods of your life, that you're ready to accept fully the cross that God wants to give to you. And everything you think is happening to you, why is he doing this? Because you're not yet ready to carry the cross that God wants to give to you. But when you are, he will show it to you, and you will die and suffer for it. And so what happens is, when you see the whole, and you understand, yes, he was wrong, and he has to admit that, but now he is ready to be the man, and to crush Taunus, which is a personification of madness and furor in the world, which must always be fought. And so what God tests each of us, and you must make the judgment not on the situation ethics, not in my case. You have to say, what is it that God wants the whole picture, and receive that from the genre of the epic. And that epic genre, of course, was used by Dante. But what other great work, and I close with this, is in the epic genre that gives us tremendous wisdom? Of course, it is the Bible. The Bible. You when you read the Bible and you read individual parts, you cannot make the judgment. You have to see the whole. And we do know the beginnings are culture of death. The beginnings is man starts off in a state that God makes him marvelous. And then he's tempted by the devil, and he doesn't accept his limitations, and everything's being destroyed. And we know that what happens is God promises the culture of life, "I will send a woman and her son, and he will crush the head of the serpent." And so the middle, usually human tragedies start with great hope and expectations and end up in death. Whereas Christian tragedy always starts off with the crucifixion and ends up in the resurrection. And so at the end of the Bible is the book of Revelation. And in the end of the Bible, we see where the woman and her son is overcoming the dragon, is overcoming, and the victory is Christ. That is what we are involved in. We're involved in the spiritual struggle in which we have our cross, but there is a resurrection. We have to struggle here, but there is a world to come. And all that you do and all that you try in this struggle for life, God will bring about the victory. There will be a reward. You know, sometimes people ask me, you know, at 9/11, where were you? And 9/11, actually at 9/10, at 11 o'clock at night, I was at the Twin Towers. I was at Ground Zero. And I had a doctor there that was from, she was from Romania. And she wanted to see one last time the great accomplishments of man. And we went, and it was 11 o'clock at night, and we saw it. And the next day, we were outside the abortion clinic, which is at the foot of New York Harbor. And you look across, you see the Twin Towers. And of course, that day, what happened was, you know, the plane crashed into one of the towers. And I was in the parish, which was the pastor, Father Delendik. And Father Delendik was one of the chaplains to the New York City Police Fire Department. There was two, Father Judge and Father Delendik. Father Judge, as people know, he died. Father Delendik almost died. And so what happened was, we were there, and while we were there, the other plane crashed into the other tower, and suddenly everybody knew this is terrorism. And the wind was blowing in our direction, and at midday, it came absolutely black, and everything was falling down. And everything in New York City stopped that day, by the way. Everything. That was absolutely essential, except for one thing, the killing of the unborn children. It did not stop. And so I could not leave. Father Delendik, he did leave, and he went down, and I didn't see him for about 48 hours. When he went down, and I did get there at midnight. But I just tell you this, you might not know this. Father Delendik said to me, he said, Father, you know, I went there, and he almost died, but the New York City Fire Department men, when the planes crashed into the second building, and it was inflamed, they turned around to Father Delendik, and they said to Father, you know, Father, this is worse than Nuremberg. This is worse than Normandy. This is something, Father, we're not coming back. We're not coming back. And they said, aren't the conditions present here for general absolution? And Father said, you're right. And those New York City firemen, they took off their helmets, and they knelt down, bowed their heads, and they asked for God's mercy. And Father absolved them all. He absolved them all. And they got up, and they put the helmets on, and they ran into the burning building. And when they got inside, as you know, in a burning building, you don't use the elevators. That's for the firemen. But when they got inside, the elevators were not working. And so these men had to go up to the 80th floor. That's where the crash was. And as they started to go up, at each level, they started to get the people out. And they saved that day 25 to 30,000 people. That's a fact. I know that. And as they started to go up each level, the people could remember. They could remember, you know, that though we were running down the stairs for our lives, and these people were going up the stairs, and they knew they were not coming back. And they got close to the 80th floor, and the whole buildings came down. And in 3 minutes, 350 firemen lost their lives. But they were changed everything in America. And suddenly, the people who were considered heroes was no longer the ball players, nor the Hollywood stars, or anyone else, but so it was mom and dad. It was ordinary people doing ordinary things, even unto the point of death. Everything changed. I did get to ground zero. It was midnight. And I got to ground zero, and I felt so helpless. You couldn't breathe. They gave this mask, and the bodies were still being pulled out. It was like an atom bomb had hit the whole area. And as he stood there with the woman who was the doctor from Romania and this engineer, and we felt so helpless, he said, let us pray the rosary. And so we started the rosary. And as we prayed the rosary, I closed my eyes. And as my eyes was closed, I could see the people in the building once again in the morning, getting ready to go over and to get ready for work, get some water, a cup of coffee, feeling so safe, so secure. And suddenly this object was to come in and destroy their security and their safety. But something happened to me at Ground Zero, something I'll never forget. With my eyes closed, I no longer saw the people in the office getting ready for work. With my eyes closed, I suddenly saw a womb. And in the womb, I saw an unborn child. And I saw that child so secure and so safe, and suddenly I saw this object, this terroristic object, coming from outside into that womb, the objects and metal and the instruments of the terrorists, of the abortionists. And then I realized, my God, Ground Zero is ongoing. Ground Zero is anywhere where unborn children's lives are being taken. Ground Zero is in Albury, Australia. You don't have to come to America to be heroes. What you have to do is to see the whole, that God is calling you to give your life for others, that your job is to be faithful, and be faithful as husband and wife, be faithful in caring for your children, be faithful in being the instruments of God's love to others until death. That's the heroes. That's the real people. That's real life. And I began to realize that. And so I say to people, you don't have to come to New York City to see Ground Zero. Ground Zero is where you are. There was a few people in this building today that just a day or two ago stood with me at Ground Zero, where we prayed for the unborn children. We prayed for their lives. You know, on Monday, last Monday, was the birth of Martin Luther King. You know, and Martin Luther King's niece, I know well, Althea King, she is pro-life. And she said to me, Martin Luther King, Father, was overwhelmingly against abortion. If he was alive today, he'd be praying with you outside the abortion mill. Take my word for it, he would. And the final talks that he gave, you know, he gave that famous talk. And in that famous talk, he said that, I got to the top of the mountain. And he says, at this top of the mountain, like Moses, he said, I can see the promised land. I can see the promised land. And the promised land is what? A promised land is where a person will be judged not by the color of his skin, but by the contents of his character. And he says, I see that land. I may not get there, but you as a people, by God, you will get there. You will get there. And after 45 years, I can say to you at the top of the mountain, I see the promised land. I see the land in which not only will people be judged by the contents of their character, not by the color of their skin, but the unborn children will be pressured because they're persons and they're humans, not because they're born or unborn, all be treated equally. And I see in America, we are going to get there. I may not get there, but America will get there. And with people like this at this dinner, I assure you, in Australia, you will get there too. Keep the whole picture in mind. Keep the whole vision. There is an end to the story, and we know the end. We already have been sure of the victory. I'd like to close with you with the words of John Paul II, that you keep this whole thing in mind. John Paul II at Denver, Colorado, speaking to the young people and to the older people, he said this, and I close with it. He says, the challenge that Christ needs you to enlighten the world and to show it the path of life. The challenge is to make the church's yes to life concrete and effective. The struggle will be long, and it needs each one of you. Place your intelligence, place your talents, your enthusiasm, your compassion, and your fortitude at the service of life. At this stage of history, the liberating message of the gospel of life has been put into your hands, and the mission of proclaiming it to the ends of the earth is now passed into your generation. Like the great apostle Paul, you too must feel the full urgency of this task. Woe to me if I do not evangelize. And he says something even further, more frightening. Woe to you if you do not succeed in defending life. Have no fear. The outcome of the battle for life is already decided. Even though the struggle goes on against great odds and with much suffering, be not afraid to go out onto the streets and into the public square and places like the first apostles who preached Christ and the good news of salvation in the squares of cities and towns and villages. This is no time to be ashamed of the gospel. It is the time to fear not and to preach it from the rooftops. God bless you.
To